All of us feel overwhelmed at times, and research shows educators are especially stressed out these days. It can leave you feeling frustrated, flattened, and burnt out. So how do you manage it? Better yet, how do you rise above it? Lisa Lucas, a teacher educator at Westchester University, has written a great new book on exactly this topic. Practicing Presence, Simple Self-Care Strategies for Teachers, is straightforward and research-based, with plenty of practical strategies teachers can use to begin achieving balance in their lives. In this podcast, we talk with Lisa about sources of teacher stress, her experiences dealing with being overwhelmed, and why no one wants to be seen in the self-help section at the bookstore.
Hey, Lisa, why are teachers so overwhelmed? Is this any different than what it was, say, 10, 20, or 30 years ago?
I think it is different from 10, 20, 30 years ago. If you'd have asked me that question even a decade ago, I'd have probably listed the typical overwhelming things like too much to do, not enough time, too many committees, changing standards, increasing need for differentiated instruction, all of those things. And I think those are all still really valid reasons for overwhelm. I think another factor with overwhelm is the typical teacher is perceived as working an 8-to-3 job. And in reality, they work, if you lived with a teacher, you would know it's an endless job. And, you know, people think, oh, you've got summers off. So I think the perception is that it's easy. So not too many teachers want to admit that they feel overwhelmed. So all of those factors. But I think I would be remiss if I didn't add, in light of the recent events and, you know, wait as far back as Sandy Hook and what happened in Florida, there's a new overwhelm, and I think it's safety. And so we're only increasing the number of factors that contribute to a teacher's feeling overwhelmed.
And it was your experience feeling overwhelmed that led to Practicing Presence, which is an interesting story.
You know, as I started to write this book, I had two different drafts going. I had the one where I was filtering out a lot of the things that made me feel vulnerable and just trying to make it more just do this to deal with overwhelm. And then I had the other draft that was sharing some things that I wasn't sure I wanted the world to know. I think the perception of me is that I've got it pretty much okay together. I mean, could be better, but I'm okay. But when I started to write and started to share really deeply what contributed to not just overwhelm, I think I described myself as feeling flattened. And I felt guilty because it wasn't just the typical, well, let me say this. There's always someone who has it worse. And so when you complain or when you say that you're overwhelmed and it's too much and you know people who are in a far worse situation, you feel guilty. And my situation was I had all of the things that I just initially described as a teacher, and I had actually very normal things that contributed to overwhelm, but that are cumulatively too much, like living with teenagers, having two aging parents who were sadly in my book of how long you should live, dying far too early, a mother with Alzheimer's that I was caring for, and a father with pulmonary fibrosis. And so caring for aging parents, teenagers, getting a doctorate, going to school at night, working all day, and in an administrative position where I think we get a lot of support when we first become teachers. We have mentoring programs, we have induction programs, but my experience, and I know this varies, about being an administrator in a school district is that you're just thrown in and told to do it, and there really is no guidebook, nor is there a built-in support system. So none of those factors are anything horrific, and we all can name a million people who've got it worse, so you keep it to yourself. But day by day, I just felt it was just a little too much. You know, the way I think of it is it was a plate, and my plate was full. And then at some point, someone gave me another giant, you know, heaping scoop of mashed potatoes and a full plate. It just tumbled and crashed to the ground. And I waved the white flag and thought, okay, I need to do something here. Because if I'm fairly competent and I can't figure this out, how is everybody else doing it? And so that's really what prompted me to start researching and writing and doing workshops on this topic.
And speaking of research, research in practicing presence is something that really elevates the work here, more so than what you typically or stereotypically associate with a topic like this. What did you find out when you first started researching this topic?
You know, no one wants to be seen in the self-help section. you know, you go to the bookstore and you start looking around at the people and where they're shopping for books, and the self-help people kind of like scurry away. And so, but I camped out there for a little bit thinking, gosh, there's got to be an answer to this. I mean, I can't be alone and just feeling that it's all too much. And what I found were a lot of 10 basic steps to joy, or 5 ways to feel inner peace, and very prescriptive type books, and also written with a little element of be happy that just wasn't practical. And so I vowed to write something that was practical, and it was also something that could be differentiated. So in other words, my book doesn't follow the typical 10 steps. What it is it's more of a menu of different things that I researched, found there was, you know, validity and reliability in the fact that it can make a difference in how you approach life, tested them out in myself, and those that worked for me, I kept in the book. Now, it doesn't mean it's going to work for everyone. And I went off the beaten path in terms of, I wanted not only to know, you know, I throughout the book, I say this a few times, reading this book isn't going to change anything. Change happens. And I did a lot of research on change theory, read a lot of Peter Senge and people that talk about change and system-wide change, and then took that perspective and internalized it for myself if I wanted a system change for myself. And what I realized is I not only needed to make some things habitual, but I call them to make those not just habits, but rituals. And to me, you know, there's a lot of different definitions for a ritual, but it has a little bit of a more inner wise self-guidance there. And the rituals for me became a way of life. And if I did them enough, it just became how I reacted. Let me take that back. How I responded rather than reacted. They were just things that I incorporated into my day. And in writing this, I know not everyone's going to find the same strategies, rituals, whatever you want to call it. They may not work for everyone, but my thought was, even if one or two worked, that would work for me. And I think some will. And every time I do a workshop, I ask people, what worked? What are you going to do? And not everyone answers the same. And I think that's indicative of the way I wanted to lay out the book so that it incorporated a wide range. I also talk in that book about things that probably teachers aren't familiar with. I don't know that many teachers are familiar with epigenetics, and I won't go into it here. You can read the book to find out more about that, but that to me was huge that I share that. I think neuroplasticity and the neuroscience is really something teachers are more familiar with. And then I talk about things like the Enneagram that really helps you better understand yourself. So I incorporate I wanted to incorporate things that aren't the typical. You can find it on the Oprah Channel. Not that Oprah Channel doesn't have some good things, but I wanted to make it research-based and bring in some new research. It's kind of like when we teach, we do the zone of proximal development. So just enough that would be pretty standard, but then adding some new and hoping that it would pique the reader's interest, that they would be discovering something new.
I really like that they brought, you know, there's so much research behind this versus more of the woo-woo Oprah sort of.
I think there needs to be a balance. I'm not really woo-woo, but yet I do things, you know, like here's an example. I thought about this morning. One of the strategies I put in there is when you wake up in the morning, on a scale of 1 to 10, pick a number about how you feel in terms of happiness or joy. So that's a little woo-woo, okay? And when you wake up, what is your number? And so I woke up today and I really was looking forward to this. And I thought, I'm an 8. And then I laughed because, God forbid, I make it a 10, right? I mean, that would just be asking too much. And I thought, you know, I'm going to go for it. So I had had on this, like just a typical shirt I would wear to work. And then I had bought a dress for Easter. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to put on a new dress. well, that took me to a 9. Okay. And then I thought of my great niece. I was packing my bag, and a few years ago we had sat in the deck by the water, and we had talked about being bright lights for other people. And she had made me a little flower that said, "We're in a bright light club." And I thought, I wonder how she's doing. So I took a picture of it and I sent it to her, and I said, "Don't forget, you need to be a bright light for others today." And you know what? In just doing that, I was like a 12. And so it's simple things like that. And yeah, that's a little woo-woo. However, if it makes a difference, it's worth it.
That was Lisa Lucas, author of Practicing Presence, Simple Self-Care for Teachers. You can find Lisa online at www.practicingpresence.life, that's L-I-F-E, and of course at stenhouse.com, where you can preview Practicing Presence. Thanks for listening.